It's interesting that writing this talk, it struck me just how much I suppose I owe to Bhante Sangharakshita, our teacher, just for his practical good sense and wise instruction, and that without it, I don't know where I'd have got my sort of moral education from, I suppose. Anyway, I thought I'd mention that. So, Sila Paramita is the so-called self-regarding aspect of the Bodhisattva's life. It's self-purification. Although, interestingly, just like Lokeshvara, when he said that, well, there's nothing wrong with giving, what could be wrong with that? I suppose Sila's a bit the same. It's not as simple as self-purification. It's not even really as simple as purification. Sila, I find, a fascinating subject. If you're ever travelling or even on beginner's retreats, when people find out that you're a Buddhist, they want to know what you can and cannot do. What are you allowed to do? They'll say, what are you allowed to get married? You know, why haven't you shaved your head? And all that sort of thing. It's quite interesting. So, two bits of news. Some good news and some bad news. The good news is you can do whatever you damn well please. Yeah, that's the good news. The bad news is that you must be intelligent and awake and responsible. Yeah, you've got to be an adult to do exactly as you please. And there aren't many of those around anymore. You need to be an adult. You need to be intelligent, awake and responsible, because you have to take responsibility fully for whatever it is that you do. Yeah. Whether you like it or not, it's a fact of life. Okay, definitions. I always like to consult the dictionary. Although consulting the dictionary with Buddhist terms is always difficult, because the Indian languages, in this case Pali and Sanskrit, tend to be much more flexible and, as it were, poetic than what we're used to. This means that we end up with one single word in Pali or Sanskrit meaning all sorts of different things in different contexts, particularly in Buddhism. And both our words here, Sila and Paramita, have more than one meaning. And Lokeshvara sort of alluded to this as well yesterday in his talk. Which means that whatever English word we use as by translation, they're not necessarily completely satisfactory. So you need to look at a range of translations of a word to sort of begin to get the feel. And sometimes you even have to go into the root in the original language and the roots of the words in the English language to really get a sense of what's actually going on, to get a sense of the spirit, I suppose, of what's being said. So sila can mean nature, character, habit, behaviour. It also means uprightness, morality, ethics. It can mean moral practice, good character. There is this implication with sila that we're looking at good habits and good character. It can mean code of morality. It can even mean Buddhist ethics in total. And then paramita literally means perfection or highest state, or that which goes beyond, or that which conveys us to the other shore. So it's both in a way the sort of the means and the result, if you like, or the way and the goal of what we're trying to do if we're practicing the paramitas. In the Mahayana, in Mahayana Buddhism, it came to refer to the qualities that the Bodhisattva must practice in order to go beyond or transcend himself and attain full and perfect enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, as we say. As you heard yesterday, there's this list of six paramitas, generosity, morality, patience, energy, meditation, wisdom, to use some English words. But there's also a list that adds four more to make 10, just to complicate things. So I thought I'd tell you what they are, just briefly. So number 7 is skillful means. Number 8 is the vow, which would take a lot of unpacking, which I'm not going to do. 9 is power, which would also take a lot of unpacking. And 10 is knowledge. Yeah, those are the 10 paramitas. So you might, if you look up paramitas in a, in a dictionary or a Buddhist book, you might find 6 or 10. You might think, well, hang on, I thought there was only 6. But you'll find with Buddhist lists that this happens quite a lot. You can get all sorts of... there are all sorts of lists in Buddhism. The 10 of this, the 5 of that, and sometimes the 5 is the 6, or it's the 8, or the 3. It really depends. To begin with, that can seem like a bit of a pain, actually. But in my experience, as you get on with things, as you get further into Buddhism, it starts to sort of free things up and make them much more flexible and much more, in a way, realistic, rather than being sort of cut and dried and lettered. Paramita. In the Mahayana, traditionally, it's stressed that each of these qualities is only a paramita in the full sense of transcendental perfection when it's joined with prajna or wisdom. Sometimes it's even said that there's really only one paramita, prajna paramita, the wisdom paramita, the wisdom that goes beyond all duality, the wisdom that transcends all mind-made distinctions and divisions, the wisdom that sees all persons and all things as no more than a flow of impersonal psychophysical processes. These impersonal psychophysical processes are themselves empty or void of any independent fixed existence. You might think you've got nothing left after that lot, but that's an extremely condensed explanation of wisdom or prajna. And if you're here for 2 weeks, Dharmadipa will no doubt unpack that a bit for you in his talk next week. That might be interesting for him. So when sila, or uprightness, or morality, is conjoined with this experience of wisdom, it becomes a paramita in the full sense. Sila is fundamentally important to Buddhist practice, and it crops up in all sorts of lists. As I said, Buddhism's full of lists, and they can be confusing, but in the end, it starts to become like a jigsaw puzzle. I think of it as the jigsaw puzzle of reality. All the different lists and the bits of Buddhism all fit together in a certain kinds of ways, and you end up with a picture of how things really are. Sila crops up and is restated over and over again throughout the history and development of Buddhism. There's the story of Bodhidharma, who was a 4th or 5th century Indian sage who took Buddhism to China and became the founder of Chan or Zen Buddhism in China. And the story goes that when he first went over to China, he had an audience with the then emperor. And the emperor was a bit of a philosopher, and he thought, okay, Buddhist sage, I'll give him a good run for his money. So they sat down together, and the emperor said, okay, what is the fundamental principle of Buddhism upon which everything else is based, from which everything else follows? And Bodhidharma, by answer, quoted a verse from the Dhammapada. And these verses from the Dhammapada are the Buddha's actual words, as far as we can tell. Yeah? And what he said was, as the answer to this question, cease to do evil, learn to do good, purify the heart. And the emperor was a bit disappointed with this. He said, is that all? Is that all? And Bodhidharma said, yes, that's all. And the emperor said, but even a child of 3 could understand that. And Bodhidharma replied, yes, even a child of 3 could understand it, but even an old man of 80 cannot put it into practice. So I rather like that little story, because, I mean, it's basically emphasising that sila is the bedrock of Buddhism, and it's not something that you can intellectually understand. You can intellectually understand it, but that's by no means going far enough with it. It's actually got to become practice and living experience, I suppose. We've got to get it out of our heads and into our second brain, into the bowels, yeah, so that it becomes part of our being. In a way, my next reference says much the same thing. This is Gampopa, who was a Tibetan teacher around about 11th century. And he said that ethics are our feet upon which we walk the spiritual life. Just as a man without feet cannot walk, so also one does not become liberated when one lacks ethics. Just as a blind man does not see forms, so one does not see the Dharma, the truth, when one is unethical. So again, you know, I find this very interesting. I mean, those are just two examples, but most books on Buddhism will mention ethics, and the better ones will actually give you some more practical insights about how to apply them. So why is being upright, why is being moral important? Why is our behaviour important? Well, according to Buddhism, everything exists or occurs on the basis of a multiplicity of causes and conditions. And again, Lokeshwara sort of touched on this yesterday. You get used to this after a while with Buddhist talks. If you hear a series of talks from different speakers on a week's retreat, they all end up crisscrossing into each other's talks. You can't really help that because, as I say, everything in Buddhism is connected to everything else. It's all of one piece. So, there is this multiplicity of causes and conditions. In other words, to put it into a really short axiom, actions have consequences. Actions have consequences. So if you make no other notes, gentlemen, write that down. Yeah, actions have consequences. Many years ago, I gave a talk where I quoted this, actions having consequences, and I said it would be good if we all had this tattooed on our foreheads so that whenever we met anybody else, we'd see actions have consequences, actions have consequences, actions have consequences, and it would really make a difference to how we lived our lives. On this particular retreat, one wag actually got somebody to write this on his forehead, and he walked around the retreat, you know. But I think it had a very positive effect, actually, actions having consequences, written across his forehead. So actions have consequences. As I said, you know, this is almost a fact of life. It's not a belief in the ordinary sense. And I just wanted to deviate a little bit here with... Because one of the things you're not asked to do in Buddhism is to believe things. There aren't any things that you have to accept. Yeah, they're all things that you must test for yourself in your own experience. And this highlights one of the difficulties I have with Christianity, particularly Thought for the Day on the radio. I don't know if you ever listen to that. In the morning, Thought for the Day on the radio. It's very interesting. You get speakers from all sorts of different religions and other sort of spheres as well, and they give a little sort of pithy talk about what might be a good thing for people to do. You know, to do with some sort of current social topic, and if it's a religious leader, they comment on it from their own religious perspective. And these are all good. In my experience, except the Christian ones. I don't know why it is. The Christians lay out their argument very logically, and then at a certain point, almost without warning, they drop in God. And you have to take it or leave it. And the assumption, they're working on the assumption, no, you've got to take this. There is God. There's no question about it. You know, there's this mind-numbing assumption that God, that this is so, God is there. And I must admit, I find this almost insulting to the intelligence, you know, that they always do this. The same thing happens, I've been to some funerals over the last several years, and the same thing happens in a funeral. You know, they sort of tell you about the person, and, you know, that, you know, they lived a good life, because usually people do. But then, you know, now they're going back to God, or whatever it is, God comes in, and everybody sort of, you know, bows their head, and you have to sort of accept this stuff. As I say, I find it sort of insulting in a way. In Buddhism, faith, Shraddha, which Lokeshwara mentioned, is a matter of personal conviction, and traditionally it's got three bases. Yeah, there's a rational basis, so it makes logical sense. Yeah, whatever it is, whatever the teaching is, whatever it is you're being taught, it should make some logical sense. However, on its own, this is not good enough. Yeah, it's not good enough on its own. You can prove anything with logic, it can always be a sort of mind trick. Socrates, the Greek philosopher, he'd get people to say what they thought, and then he'd talk to them, and in the process of the conversation, he'd get them to say the opposite. And he did this again and again and again. And at the end of it, people didn't know what had happened, kind of thing. So logic on its own is not good enough. But it is useful. Yeah, we do need to use it. The second basis is intuition, that it feels right. Yeah, it should actually resonate with us in some way, in some more sort of emotional or intuitional sort of kind of way. But again, this on its own is not good enough. Yeah, on its own, it's not good enough. The third basis is experience. So slowly, gradually, through your own personal experience, you come to know increasingly that a particular teaching is so, that it is the way things are. Again, on its own, this is not necessarily a good base, yeah, because we can convince ourselves of all sorts of things that we think and feel we're very sure of, and they turn out not to be the case. Yeah, so all three, you need all three, and you need what I tend to think of in Buddhism is the sort of esoteric fourth basis. Yeah, there's a fourth factor, and that is the testimony of the wise. However, there are difficulties with that, because you've got to work out who the wise actually are for yourself. And again, we can be misled by clever, charismatic people who may lead us astray for their own reasons. That's in a way that's their business. Well, it's your business as well if you're on the receiving end of it, isn't it? But any one of those on its own is not enough. And I would suggest that if you put the four together, you're starting to get a reasonably good tilt at what the truth may actually be. Yeah. If you apply all these three, and this is what you're asked to do in Buddhism, you have to put these four together, talk and discuss with your fellow practitioners, and explore your own doubts and misgivings about whatever the particular Buddhist teaching is. Even if there are issues you don't agree with in Buddhism, there is the injunction to put whatever it is to one side for the moment. And assuming that you're interested and convinced enough to carry on exploring, revisit that teaching again later, again and again and again. Because if Buddhism works, you'll start to mature, you'll grow and develop, and you'll find that the second time you look at that teaching, it may actually look a bit different. The third time, it may actually look a little bit more different again. And slowly, slowly, you may become able to appreciate what it's actually saying, and that it has some validity. So don't, if you can, don't just throw things out wholesale. It's a shame if you do that. So that's faith in the full Buddhist sense. You don't have to believe anything. In fact, you know, you need to test things for yourself. And this is brought out in a line in the Tiratnavandana that we've been chanting every morning. I don't know if you're aware of this, but in the Dharma section of the Tiratnavandana, it goes, Svākāto bhagavatā dhammo sanditiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pachatāṁ veditābho vinyuhiti. Yeah? So ehipasiko opanayiko pachatāṁ veditābho vinyuhiti means, ehipasiko means roughly come and see for yourself. Yeah? Opanayiko means progressive. It's a path. Yeah? It's a thing that's alive and moving. Pachata means personally. Veditabo, to be known. Vinyuhiti, by the wise. So the implication is that you've got to sort of test this over time, become wise, and you'll find that it's progressive and you'll grow through it. Yeah, that's what it's saying to us. So it's not just a load of, if you're new to the Tiratnavandana, it's not just a load of, old Indian gobbledygook. It's saying something, yeah? All the words and the things that we chant in the Indian languages have meaning, and those meanings are important. So, don't be a sort of a ventriloquist dummy. Find out what those things mean, yeah? And then try saying them and see what effect it has, yeah? Again, it's not enough just to sort of sit there with your mouth moving. It'll have much more effect if you can put some energy into it and some volume. Even if you don't think you mean it, even if you're not quite sure what it means. You won't find out anything by just sort of, you know, passively taking it in. Put yourself into it and see what happens. See whether it affects you. Then you'll start to know. Come and see for yourself, yeah. Now, why did I put that in? That's it. Ah, right, yes, the progressive thing. That's it, the progressive thing, yeah. This sort of thought cropped up while I was thinking about this talk. If you ever come across a fundamentalist Buddhist, avoid him. Yeah, avoid him like the plague, because a fundamentalist is trying to get you to believe something. For lazy people, fundamentalism is wonderful because you just go, what do I have to know? What do I believe? They tell you, and then you just go away and do it like a sort of puppet. Yeah. It makes things very, very easy. You don't have to think about anything. There's no conflict. You just do what they say. Yeah. But it's very, very dangerous, especially for yourself. Yeah. It's very dangerous indeed. And I don't know. I don't know if you've heard about this. If you're new to the movement, you might not be aware of this. But mitras of Ask for Ordination, mitras, alder members, even long-standing alder members go on what we sometimes call a wide orbit. Yeah, they sort of go out of contact a bit, and you don't quite know what they're up to, you know, and it doesn't look like they're practicing or anything else. I tend to think that's good, because one way or another, I think what they're doing is they're intellectually or emotionally, they're sort of processing what their life is about and what Buddhism means to their life. I think it's a very important sort of stage of one's development. I've done it a little bit myself in the past. I've gone off for a while and just had to reassess things, yeah? So we should never sort of, I think it's, you know, we should be careful of drawing a tight line and saying, okay, if you're not doing this, you're not a Buddhist. Or if you're not doing this, you're not a member of the Western Buddhist Order. It's very, very dangerous, very, very dangerous, because people process things, they process their experience in all sorts of different ways. So avoid Buddhist fundamentalists if you come across them. So actions having consequences. We're acting all the time. It's difficult not to act. And in our better moments, I think we can recognise that often when we're acting, we're more or less out of control. We can see that our actions are having difficult or even disastrous consequences for ourselves. And if we're particularly turned on and switched on, we might even recognise that our actions have disastrous and difficult consequences for the other people that we come into contact with. Although that's not so obvious to us, maybe for quite a long time. But that's what happens, I think. And in Buddhism, it's all actions. Yeah, it's not just bodily actions, but it's actions of the tongue. It's our speech. That's counted as an action in Buddhism. Actions of the mind, our thoughts, those two have consequences. Yeah, in fact, the actions of our mind are probably the most weighty actions that we perform. But because they're not very conscious, it's difficult. Bodily actions are much more obvious, aren't they? Because you knock over the vase and there's a mess and it needs to be cleared up. You can trail off an insult and it doesn't look like it has any effect at all, and you go away and you think nothing's happened. But it's having consequences. The things you say to people affect them very deeply. I know when I was a little boy, I don't know whether this is just working class circles, but there used to be a saying in the playground, oh, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Rubbish. Names can be intensely painful to be on the receiving end of. And we trot them out all the time, little quips and comments. They have consequences, and we need to be aware of those for other people. So actions of body, speech and mind in the past have made us what we are now. They create our present circumstances. Fact of life, yeah? Actions of our body, speech and mind now will make us what we are in the future. They create our future circumstances. Fact of life. So it's important, it's very important to bring awareness or mindfulness to bear on our behaviour so that we know and are conscious of our physical behaviour. We know where we are, what we're doing and where we're going physically. We're aware of our speech so that we know what we're saying, why we're saying it and what the consequences of it might turn out to be. And we're aware of our thoughts so that we know what we're thinking, why we're thinking it, and what the consequences of our thoughts might turn out to be. And I know that's a very, very tall order. Yeah. I don't know, I mean, I've been at this lark for more than 30 years, and it's a question of sort of nibbling away at something, you know, slowly, slowly, you begin to get a little bit more awareness of what it is you're thinking, why you might be thinking it, and where that might lead you. And, you know, you make mistake after mistake after mistake. It's only through failing, I think, that we learn things. And with awareness of thoughts, we're going to fail again and again. So as Samuel Beckett would say, fail more, fail better, but keep failing. Keep trying with your awareness of your thoughts. So we need some criteria against which to evaluate our actions and our behaviour. But I'll come back to this probably near the end. So on what basis do we act? You know, what causes us to act? Physically, verbally and mentally. Well, it's the emotions, isn't it? Emotion, that's what's moving us. And often these are blocked or stifled or coarse, and our conditioning through our life to date has sort of moulded and formed them and compressed them into all sorts of funny shapes. Yeah. Sometimes we're moved or motivated by unconscious Christian ethics. Oh dear, I didn't realise this was going to be a Christianity bashing session. I don't necessarily think it's all bad, I assure you. It's not difficult, though, for us, if we're certainly in the UK, I would say, it's not difficult. It is difficult for us not to take our unconscious Christian conditioning into Buddhism, particularly in the area of ethics and morality, in terms of what is acceptable behaviour. I mean, that's because all this stuff about how a good Christian or even a bad Christian behaves, I mean, it's not like anybody tells you this stuff. You sort of imbibe it, don't you, out of the carpet, you know, at your mother's feet kind of thing. She doesn't say to you, oh, this is how you should behave kind of thing. Or she might say that, but you just watch people, and this is a Christian country, there's loads of churches around, you know, there's this guy upstairs who's pulling all the strings maybe, and this is just what you do, and it's going in before you even begin to think about it. So if you're not careful, it goes in and you haven't thought about it at all, and it's just turned itself into sort of emotional responses that you don't have any control over. Bhante came out with this little sort of summation of what traditional ethics today are like, which some of you might have heard before. He said that a general sort of approach to it is that we're not doing what we want to do, and we're doing what we don't want to do because, for reasons which we don't understand, we've been told so by someone in whose existence we no longer believe. And he says, no wonder we're confused. And I think that's a pretty accurate sort of evaluation of what goes on with these unconscious, Christian conditionings. Good or bad, you know, I'm not saying that Christianity is all bad. One of the things that Bhante says about Christianity, though, is that it doesn't tend to look at its morality in psychological terms. And this is part of the danger. This makes it very dangerous. And I think things have got quite a bit better because, the psychological, so to speak, has started to take the upper hand with the ascendance of science. Not that that's all good. You know, there are difficulties with science. But what it means is that we tend to look at things a bit more psychologically. And that, again, can be overdone. But There's a lot about psychology in Buddhism. Buddhism's got a very strong, and I would say almost watertight, psychology to it. So there are lots of sort of overlaps with the sort of general counselling and psychotherapy sort of way of looking at things. Psychotherapy, counselling and all that stuff, looks at and attempts to expose the voices inside us which we're answering, in a sense. Sometimes it's like that, isn't it? Sometimes you do something, you don't know why you've done it. But sometimes you hear a voice that says, oh no, you must do that. We've got these internal voices very often. And we need to be aware of the basis on which these voices are issuing instructions, if that's what they're doing, whether or not they're telling us the truth, and what the consequences of obeying these voices might be. Very interesting. We can ask ourselves, in other words, is my behaviour in certain areas unconscious and automatic? What might those areas be? Where might those responses have come from? If they are, if our behaviour in certain areas is unconscious and automatic, or if it is like that, this sort of behaviour, this sort of ethics, is considered by Buddhism to be a fetter. It's something that binds us to mundane existence and stops us growing. It's a barrier that keeps us from the transcendental. And this is this idea is the third on the list of another set of lists, the 10 fetters. Yeah, there's a list of 10 fetters which stop us from moving forwards, if you like. And the first three are said to be particularly important. They're the three that you sort of grapple with first. So I'll tell you, I'll briefly run through the first two and then we'll go on to the third. I'll say a bit more about that, yeah, because it's the third one which concerns us. So the first fetter is belief in a self. The belief that I am I. I'm fixed and I'm final and I'm the centre of the universe. My personal individual existence is irreducible and ultimate. Buddhism says that will stop you growing, changing and evolving. Yeah, it will fix you an extremely bad way. Second fetter is doubt. But it's not doubt in the sense of not knowing all the facts and therefore not being able to make an not being able to make an objective inquiry. It's what Banti describes somewhere as a soul-corroding unease that won't settle down in anything, that is full of fears, humours and whimsicalities, that won't be satisfied, doesn't want to know, and shies away from knowing, that won't try to find out, and then complains that it doesn't know. Yeah, that's the definition of this second fetter, doubt. The third fetter, and the one that concerns us here, is dependence on moral rules and religious observances as ends in themselves. And I think this is brilliant. This is a masterstroke of the Buddha's, I presume it comes from the Buddha, because it's like you're actually having to question, hopefully in a positive sense, the very things that you're doing to take you forward. You don't lose your questioning sense, yeah? Because as soon as you lose that, you turn into, the victim of fundamentalism if you're not very careful. So something may be a very good means to an end, but if it becomes an end in itself, it becomes a hindrance. That's really what this fetter is saying. Meditation is very good. Yeah, it's brilliant. The ethical life is very good. Studying Buddhist texts is very good. Even going on retreat is very good. But if it becomes an end in itself, it becomes a hindrance. It can manifest as superficiality, a going through the motions. And when that happens, it becomes very, very difficult to break. It's very difficult to break through this sort of being on the receiving end of fundamentalism if you begin to accept it. So this sort of fetter can't be broken by giving up the rules, the rituals, the religious observances. That's the obvious sort of reaction. Yeah, it's not a creative approach to just throw it all out the window. This fetter is broken by following the rules, rituals, religious observances as wholeheartedly as you can, but without any attachment to them, as ends in themselves, yeah? As a means, what you're trying to do is use them as a means to integrating yourself to the point of wisdom. Yeah, and again, in Buddhism, there's this teaching of the raft. The Buddha's teaching, he says, is it's a raft to get you across the sea of samsara. Yeah, when you get to the other side, you don't need the raft anymore. You don't pick it up and put it on your shoulders and carry it across the mountains. Yeah, complete waste of time. It's a means to an end. All Buddhist practice is a means to an end, and it's the end that we're after. But if you get too caught up with the means, it becomes a hindrance. One can do any practice for the wrong reason. Even be a Buddhist for the wrong reasons. No practice is entirely safe from a spiritual point of view. And Banti points out that this third fetter warns us that any spiritual practice can be undertaken wrongly and therefore could be dangerous. He says, and this is a quote here, to ask for a completely safe practice is to ask for a practice in which attitude doesn't matter. A practice which is always sure to be the right thing to do, but that is impossible. Attitude always counts. Where there is the possibility of skillfulness, there is also the possibility of unskillfulness, until one becomes a stream entrant. I don't know if you're familiar with this category. I think Lokeshwar mentioned stream entry, didn't you? Stream entry said to be it's a sort of Theravada monastic Theravada sort of term, and it's or category, and it's the idea is that you reach a certain point where the pull of the condition, the pull of the world, no longer affects you, and you've actually tipped over into the pull of the unconditioned. You're in the stream, so to speak, on the way to liberation, nirvana, enlightenment. And in a sense, you don't need to make any effort anymore. That's a long way off, so don't think about that for the moment. Buddhist ethics is an ethics of intention. Yeah, the attitude is vital. The state of mind which drives any action of body, speech or mind is particularly important. The Dhammapada, again, as I said, it's probably the words of the Buddha. The first two verses of chapter one indicate that mind is the forerunner. Yeah? Mind leads. Everything else that you do follows in the wake of your mind. Yeah, as the how does it go? As surely as the wheel of the cart follows the hoof of the ox. Yeah, something like that. I think the verse goes. Now you'll notice in that little quote of Banti's that he speaks of skillful and unskillful. And this is completely traditional. And again, as far as we know, goes back to the Buddha himself. So in Buddhism, we don't speak of actions of body, speech and mind as being good or bad, but as being skillful and unskillful. And this is very important. The words used in Buddhism are, one version of them is, skillful is kusala and unskillful is akusala. So you'll find these cropping up in Buddhist texts all over the place. It's important because the use of the word skill suggests training. It suggests repeated practice. It suggests a body of experience. It suggests intelligence and the ability to learn by mistake. Again, it implies this mysterious quality, mindfulness, which seems to be a quality or faculty, a skill even, that's peculiar to Buddhism alone. It doesn't seem to crop up anywhere else. Lots of other religions and ways of thought have sort of borrowed it, but it starts with the Buddha, mindfulness. Also, this talking in terms of skillful and unskillful avoids absolutes. One can be more or less skilled, whereas if you're good or bad, you tend to be stuffed, don't you? You're fixed. Yeah? If you're good, you're good, and that's it. And we were having a talk in our discussion group this morning about, I think, the British sort of social norm and legal system is run on the possibility that, or on the basis that, you know, once you've been convicted, that's it. You know, you'll never change. That's not what Buddhism always says, that there is always the possibility of change, although it's very, very difficult to ascertain whether or not somebody has changed. It's easy to go through the, the motions. So according to Buddhism, unskillful actions, the akusala, are rooted or based upon the negative mental states of greed, hatred and delusion. So it's worth bearing that in mind, yeah? That when we're in a sort of a negative mental state, that's what's driving us. Greed, hatred and delusion. Emotions, yeah? They're emotions. Skillful actions are rooted in or based upon mental states free from greed, hatred and delusion. They're motivated by generosity, metta, compassion and by understanding. So our attitude, our state of mind, the reason or motive for any action we perform can be more important even sometimes than the action itself. And this is you know, quite an interesting business. Oh, hang on. Yep, no, that's all right. I'm doing all right. Good. So, for instance, we were talking about this in our, to some extent in our group this morning. Giving money to a beggar. Why might you do that? Yeah, you might do it to get rid of them. Yeah, because you're irritated with them, or you just feel indifferent to them, and you know, so you just give them some money to get rid of them. You might tell them to clear off. Yeah, that's another way of dealing with them. You might give them money to get rid of them because you feel guilty or responsible in some way. Yeah? Same action, might look the same from the outside, but there's a different sort of mental basis to it. Or you might give money to a beggar because you're trying to cultivate generosity. Yeah? Or you might give it out of a sense of compassion and a desire to help, however misplaced that might be. Yeah? And there are difficulties with this, of course. Same thing, to bring it a bit more sort of internal, look at, say the desire to steal something. I don't know if you've ever had this. I mean, I've been practicing Buddhism 35 years now, a long time. And but sometimes I go into a shop and I'll ask for something, and you know, you sort of, and the person who's serving hasn't got it on the counter, so they go out the back, and you sort of, you think, there's no cameras in here, and you look at the camera, and you think, God, I could nick that. What am I doing? I still find that happens. I still have this little thought pops up. I could nick that now because they've gone out the back. I mean, so far it hasn't happened. I try to keep that down. You have to resist these things. But it's interesting that happens, isn't it? So resisting the desire to steal. You might do that because you're afraid of getting caught and being punished. Yeah, that might be one reason why you resist. You might be doing it because you might resist the desire to steal because you're trying to practice honesty. Or you might resist the desire to steal because you're so integrated and wise that the idea or urge to steal does not arise. Yeah. It's no longer possible for you to sustain the train of thought that might give rise to stealing. And it's interesting, they say of the stream entrance, somebody who sort of tipped this balance and no longer has to make any effort, supposedly, that they might have negative mental states. You know, they can get a bit angry, but they're not capable of sustaining a train of angry thoughts. It comes up, they get a bit irritated, they realise they're irritated, and it's like, no, they've got control to a large extent, which is, it's a very interesting idea that you could have that sort of degree of control. So, as a philosopher once said, we are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. Perhaps we should add that it needs to be a conscious and a skillful habit, yeah? Because unconscious habits are dangerous, and unconscious, unskillful habits are extremely dangerous to ourselves and other people. Okay, another distinction that Buddhism has made with its attitude to morality from the earliest times is to discriminate between natural morality and conventional morality. So natural morality refers to behaviour that's directly related to mental states. It's directly referring to this attitude of mind that you might have, yeah? Conventional morality is a matter of custom and tradition, depending on where you happen to be, what your cultural conditioning is, or where, you know, the culture that you happen to be in. Conventional morality also includes matters of etiquette and manners. Not that these are wrong, but sometimes you can go through the motions with etiquette and manners again, yeah? So whether or not you remove your hat in a place of worship, for instance, usually depends more upon the local custom rather than the degree of reverence one is actually experiencing. And to bring it closer to home, you're saying, well, I'm not actually a Buddhist, I'm interested in Buddhism. But you'll notice that the old hands, for one reason or another, when they come into the shrine, they bow, yeah? Well, they even bow to that, you know, that pile of concrete out in the yard, yeah? What on earth is going on? Why are they doing that, you know? Is that just a sort of habit? You know, are they just sort of, Pavlov's dogs? You know, there's the pile of concrete, so they bow. Is that it? Or is there something else going on? Do you know what I mean? It's an interesting question to ask, isn't it? There are all sorts of reasons. I know one friend of mine says that when he goes into a shrine room, sometimes he bows and sometimes he doesn't, because he's not quite sure how he feels about it yet. It's quite interesting. And I think, again, that that's good. You know, it's easy to sort of, if you're an old hand like me, you might see somebody walk straight into the shrine and you think, God, you know, insensitive Balaam, you know, why didn't he bow? Sort of thing. But no, he's, hopefully, if I give him the benefit of the doubt, he's testing his own experience. Maybe sometimes he does bow. Maybe one day he will bow and he'll think, oh, yeah, this is quite a good thing to do, you know. But if it becomes a habit again, you've lost it, yeah. So maybe even for older hands like me, you know, it's good now and again just not to bow and see what happens. How does that feel? Why do you feel like that when you don't bow? You know, what's that actually saying about your state of mind and your conditioning? So interesting stuff. You have to keep testing. And it's interesting that in Buddhism as a whole, there are some very old training principles which have got nothing to do with natural morality. For instance, it seems that wearing yellow robes and shaving one's head is purely conventional. It's purely conventional. It doesn't have any sort of, not directly sort of attitudinal basis. I'm not saying that it doesn't have any worth at all, because we have robe wearing and voluntary head shaving if you go on the 4-month ordination course in Spain to join the Western Buddhist Order. So it does go on. What I'm saying in effect is that thinking makes it so. Yeah, and I know some people have quite a sort of tussle with themselves. Do they or do they not want to wear a robe when they get ordained? Will they or will they not shave their head? Some people shave their heads. Some people go in with a shoulder-length lock and they come out with a shoulder-length lock. That's left to you, yeah? It's your own choice. But you have to... I mean, I think even the fact that the question is raised is good, because you're thrown back on your attitude. Okay, why am I attached to this long hair if I've got long hair? Why am I just shaving my head? Am I just doing that because of everybody else? Or... you know, have I ever done it before? It might be an interesting thing to do. You know, what are the consequences of that physically, you know, and mentally? Experiment. We have to keep experimenting. I suppose you have to sort out, I mean, one's attitude gives these activities symbolic significance or not. Yeah. And again, to give something symbolic significance, you have to sort of access a part of your being, which is not necessarily so easily accessed. You know, the more sort of poetic, Banti calls it, the sort of the imaginal faculty has to be grown for you to be able to respond to something and its symbolic significance. In Buddhism, in Buddhist countries rather, this can become extremely important again, because... very often in traditional Buddhist countries, the laity want their bhikkhus to be good ones. Yeah? And generally that means seen to be good. Yeah? Even if those bhikkhus are bad Buddhists, because they don't do any spiritual practice at all. If they keep their head nicely shaved, they don't eat after 12 o'clock, they have their lower robe exactly 6 to 8 inches above the ankles kind of thing, everything's all right. As soon as they let their hair grow too long, they get ticked off by the laity. And the laity might even refuse to feed them anymore. This is the sort of thing that goes on in Buddhist countries, because they're not being good monks. Yeah? Never mind whether they meditate or not. And it seems that in the East, lots of monks don't meditate. Yeah? It can be another sort of job it's a way of getting a livelihood for some people in some Eastern countries. So again, we have to sort of question these things. In the West, people can feel very guilty about not following conventional morality. I come from a working class, East London working class circle, and it was obvious to me, watching my and an extended family to some extent as well, and it was interesting to me watching my family, because not being in a job, being paid to work was a bad thing, and if there was anybody in my extended family who wasn't working in a paid job, they got a lot of pressure from the rest of the family. You should be working. No explanation about why they should be working, you know, and what effect that might have on them. They should be working because that's what you do. Very, very interesting. Very interesting thing, I suppose. Banti's also described this sort of, these two poles as the difference between virtue and respectability. So respectable here means looking upright, appearing to be squeaky clean. Yeah. So one can be virtuous and respectable at the same time, yeah? Or one can be virtuous and not respectable, yeah? That's a possibility. Or one could be not virtuous, but extremely respectable. And it's interesting the way our sort of society is going at the moment, isn't it? Because in the last... I don't know, what would it be, 10 to 15 years, the image of the good politician has sort of gone down the drain, hasn't it, with Watergate and all the rest of it. And now there are revelations, even in this country, all our political parties suffer from revelations. People are sort of, they're being nice MPs on one side, and on the other side, they're up to some funny little trick or other, or doing something that other people think is a bit naughty and they shouldn't be doing. Very interesting stuff. This all says something about I suppose the importance of morality. So Banti says, again, this is a direct quote, one should not entangle a matter of real substantial virtue, a matter of natural morality, with one's prejudices about what is right and wrong, which may be based merely on local custom and have nothing to do with skillful or unskillful mental states. It's quite important to be sure within oneself whether one is really leading a moral life or just respecting the prejudices of the group within which one happens to be. Moral life is essentially a matter of skillful mental states expressed in skillful behaviour and skillful speech. So as our meditation practice develops, we slowly become a bit more aware and mindful, at least from time to time. As our understanding and practice of Buddhism grows, it's as if we remember more and more frequently each month, perhaps each week, perhaps each day, that we're attempting to make our actions of body, speech and mind more conscious. Never mind turning them into something skillful, yeah? This process gradually informs more and more of the key areas in our life. And there are a number of these. And it's important for this sort of mindfulness and this sort of awareness to permeate them. And to name some of the major areas, food. The food that we eat, where it comes from, what sort of food it is, how we eat it, is all very important. Sleep. How much or how little of it we get is very important, particularly to a spiritual practice. Work, the sort of work that we do is very important to our lives. It's central to our lives, because we spend so much time doing it, whatever it is. So it's important what that is. It's having a strong effect on us. Sex, the arrangements we make for sexual gratification or not, are a big deal, yeah? It's one of the taboos, isn't it, what we do about sex. It's important to bring awareness into this area and work out why we do the things that we do, why we make the choices that we make. Could we make better choices? Could those choices be more skillful? Could they be less harmful, etc.? to self or and other. Marriage, you know, the sort of arrangements we make for marriage. I mean, in this country, the norm is one man and one woman, isn't it? In Buddhism, it's not like that at all. You go to Buddhist countries and you can get, what are they, monogamy? Monogamy is one-to-one, isn't it? Polyandry and what's the other one? Polygamy, that's it. They're all perfectly acceptable in Buddhist countries, as long as everybody's happy with them and they're reasonably skillful. There's no problem, you know, one man with a number of wives or one woman with a number of husbands. It's not a problem. It's not a big deal. And nor is marriage sanctioned in heaven. You might get a blessing off the monks, but it's just an arrangement you make with other people, and then you tell the rest of society that you're married, and you are. You don't need any bits of paper or anything else. If you're living together, you're married. Money, the great taboo as well, which I was talking to Stephen about the other day, wasn't I? Yeah. What we do with our money, where it comes from, has got very big implications, ethically speaking. Far too many to go into. So some of these are quite emotive areas, and even just raising them as subjects can make people a bit twitchy. But they're all areas where we can begin to have an increasing awareness and even some conscious control. And as I say, Buddhism has something to say about all of them. One's openness and flexibility of attitude to all these will have a profound effect upon one's ability to establish a regular spiritual practice. And actually, there isn't any other kind of spiritual practice. If it's not regular, it's not a spiritual practice. It's a sort of, it's a dabble from time to time. So flexibility of attitude, and hence will have a profound effect upon one's ability and freedom even to grow and develop. I've nearly finished. That's not too bad. I'm not going on too long, I hope. So you can talk about all those subjects in your group, yeah, and you know what your attitude to them is: food, sleep, work, sex, marriage, money, and what sort of arrangements you make. For a Buddha, skillful actions of body, speech, and mind are spontaneous and the natural expression of wisdom, compassion, and love. That's just the way he or she is. There are certain kinds of behaviour that they just would not or do not perform. Yeah, they are said to be incapable of unskillful action. So I said, like the stream entrant, he's getting there. Yeah, he can have these sort of arising negative mental states, but he can't sort of maintain them. The Buddha doesn't have them at all. They just do not enter his head. Now, I said some time back that we need some criteria against which to evaluate our actions and our behaviour, and I would suggest that these are the 5 or the 10 precepts. And I could go through them, but time is running out, and I'm pretty sure that any order member or reasonably experienced mitra in the room could give you a detailed rundown of what they mean and the spirit in which they should be undertaken. So I won't do that. I'll just read you a little bit of Bhante again, and then I'll give you one little piece of advice. Yeah. So Bhante says, you can find this in this book on sale in the foyer, which includes this book, or little booklet, Aspects of Buddhist Morality, which is very good. And some of the ideas I've told you about today come from this. So Bhante says, if the 10 ways of skillful action, that's the 10 precepts, in other words, if mundane morality is not practiced, even to a slight extent, men will not be reborn again as human beings, and the human order of conditioned existence will come to an end. Morality is therefore necessary to the maintenance of the human state. It is necessary to the maintenance of human society. That is a society with human values. So we need morality if we're going to have any sort of human in the fullest sense of the term. Yeah, any human interaction and society, there must be an ethical basis for that. My one piece of advice, as I leave you, if you cannot act ethically in any situation that you find yourself in, get out of it as fast as you can and avoid it in future.